It's been very stimulating, I think, for the group, for all of us. And here we are at the last chapter in the afterword. And I've already talked to a few people at the beginning of the class. It has definitely stimulated an awareness of oneself as a practitioner in the world, and what that actually means. And that's what this final chapter is. We're exploring further. We talked about it a bit last week. But it's one thing to be a practitioner on the cushion. It's an entirely different experience. It feels off the cushion. But a lot of the same things are operative. So we'll get into that. The chapter begins with this sort of Chögyam Trungpa talking about this invitation, the sense of invitation that he had to come to the States, to the West, to teach. It's an extraordinary story, and we don't have time to go into it here, but there are wonderful resources, some mentioned in this book. Born in Tibet is, I don't remember, was that mentioned in this book?
I think in the back, yeah.
In the back you'll find a number of references. But what essentially happened is that he went from, he landed in England at Oxford. And then from there he met people and was invited to come to the States. I think he first arrived in Canada. Mm-hmm. And so there's that literal invitation, but there's also the sort of cultural invitation that was taking place, which was, those of you who remember, who were there, might remember, you might not be able to remember anymore, but the 70s, late 60s and 70s was quite
a lot of these people.
The whole culture was sort of in upheaval, and materialism was starting to be very powerful. I mean, it had been a powerful force, but the Vidyadhara talks about aggression, there being a lot of aggression and confusion. He said America's fundamental psychological confusion had become thickened with increasing frustration, fear, and anger. And if you think of the protests of the 60s and the assassinations, and so there was a whole kind of churning, cultural churning going on. And on top of that, there were a lot of people who had turned towards the East to look for teaching. So there was this kind of interesting confluence of energies. And so the invitation that was issued to Chögyam Trungpa was much more than just come on and teach here. It was sort of the culture was inviting, was wanting to be awakened in a spiritual sense. And of course, previous to that, there had been Alan Watts, there had been a number of, sort of in the 60s and even previous to that, but it became the momentum sort of took off at that point. So, but he responded very specifically to America's manifestation of aggression, frustration, fear, and anger. And there's a lot of, I know Emily and I have been saying this throughout the whole thing, almost every other sentence there's something that you just want to go into even more deeply. But on page 154, if you want to open your books, we'll go through this, and there may be some things that like you might want to read. He talks about American neurosis. Let me just see here. He says, in particular, the American spiritual neurosis, both individual and as a group, had become in some sense a world monument. It deserves a gold medal.
Right.
So introducing disciplines for seeing the world in a very simple, ordinary, and basic way seems helpful and refreshing and very much needed. That's why I came here. And that's why the meditative tradition of mindfulness was so appropriate for this country as well as the rest of the Western Hemisphere. It isn't just that we, and he makes it very clear, it wasn't just that we're a culture lacking in tradition or value. It's that the kind of churning that was taking place was really juicy and good and workable and could be, people were really awake to feeling. There was already a leap into the willingness to hear and see. And so he, in this chapter and in the following one, he really continually talks about, and we'll get into this, how all this is good news and workable. So from the us on our cushions with our yakety yakety yak going on in our heads, mm-hmm. to bumping up against somebody and watching our own shit come out, you know, our own aggression or jealousy or whatever come out. It's all juicy, workable, delicious material for waking up. There was a phrase years ago talking about emotions and used about all of our crap is manure on the field of Bodhi. So it's not rejectable. It's useful, in fact, necessary for the waking up process. So it isn't about being good little boys and girls so you can get to be better little holy girls and boys. It's about actually working with who you are on the spot with all the beauty and all our embarrassing little bits. So he also, in this chapter, refers to ego. He sort of does a there's a kind of a review that takes place in this chapter that sort of taps into things that we discussed and in the following one, in the acknowledgement. I'm sorry, not acknowledgement.
Afterwards.
All these things that we discussed during the course of the course. Like that. And one, he goes back to the skandhas.
Right.
I'm really sorry. But he explained it in a completely wonderful way. So we could look at that. And he talks about ego as well. Mm-hmm. He describes ego a few times in this chapter. One I liked is individual ignorance and self-centeredness.
Where's that?
Here, it's right under, it's on page 154.
It's the second paragraph.
The second full paragraph down. Mm. Would you like to read that, Elise?
The paragraph?
Yes.
Mindfulness in particular can address the problems generated by our individual ignorance and self-centeredness, which is what I have here called ego. To address this, we can use a personal means or discipline such as the practice of meditation. We can't blame this problem on anybody else. We might think the others made the mistake. However, our basic bewilderment is ours.
So, actually, I would be really pleased if you would continue a little bit.
Okay. We would like to maintain this bewilderment. It becomes an occupation, one that we attempt to perpetuate. In truth, we can't maintain the confusion throughout our lives 24 hours a day. At first, there seems to be a smooth pathway, but there are lots of gaps. There are big holes in the road that we might fall into, and we're afraid of those holes. We would like to have smooth living, with our neurosis operating seamlessly, simultaneously with our paranoia all the time.
So we clearly can't do that. We run up against our...
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
It's so hard.
Actually, it is hard, though. We are even a little bit... we don't really like being asleep, actually, which is what brings us to meditation and, you know, this sort of our essential inner wakefulness before we even know there's such a thing as meditation sort of pulls us to it, to investigating it. We know we're in a big sloppy mess. And it's more comfortable, but really isn't ultimately comfortable. We're used to it, but it's not comfortable. So that's what we're talking about here. He says, until we've actually sat in practice, we'll never completely know the truth about what's happening in our heads and in our hearts. That's why we practice meditation. Incidentally, if you have any questions or you want to say something, yes. Yes. Electra, we're going over the material. So, and he's talking also about a word that doesn't come up a whole lot in this chapter, but was in my mind as I was reading it, was about materialism, that we're sort of bumped up against our things, our literal things, and our own thinginess drives us mad. You know, we start being annoying even ourselves, being in our own way, and the claustrophobia of that sort of it inspires us to go further. He says it's not a religious conversion that he's talking about. Mm-hmm. It's making an investment in our innate sanity. Because death will actually happen.
I love the line where he says, how long can we go on being window shoppers on the path of life rather than making a real investment in our innate sanity?
Yeah.
Which is sort of that interesting idea, like, well, someday I'll do that. Someday I'll be a nice person.
Exactly.
Someday I'll be compassionate.
And he's also referring to that in terms of spiritual shopping. That was
right,
another.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, that other piece.
Yeah, I don't always sort of assume materialism was not specifically just about stuff, but it was, you know, like I heard the, what is it?
Kind of,
it seemed to be much more about, you know, clinging to, you know, clinging to concepts as much as clinging to objects.
Absolutely.
It's distraction.
Yes.
And attachment.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Always wanting entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even in our misery.
Yes. Who can I tell this story to about how screwed up this was? Or who can I tell this story to about how, what this incredible experience I had? It's just, you know, in a way, we need them both. But in a way, we also have to see through them both.
The way we use stories to change our feelings. We don't like the feeling that we're experiencing, so we wrap a different story around it so that we can change it, so we can abide by it, feel better about it.
We do that all the time, don't we?
Yeah.
That's me and mine. That's my point of view, and it's right because it's mine. So we'll do whatever it takes to end up right. I've never experienced this before.
But you read about it.
So, that's right.
I read recently an article that said if you're going into this soul awakening journey and you expect there to be some like rainbow and pot of gold at the other side, you're really mistaken about what the journey is. It's actually really... you're walking into something that's going to be sort of
not perpetually glorious and peaceful, but sort of perpetually difficult.
In fact, you've agreed to that, to me. We were talking about this earlier, that once you start practicing, you actually agree that that's what you're going to do.
Yeah.
You're kind of like the sign on the dotted line. This is going to really hurt. Right? Because once you start sitting, and we were talking about this earlier, all this stuff comes up that you have not looked at. And it's young.
Yeah. See, I was just telling you, like, I feel like my life has gotten worse in a way.
Wonderful.
There are all things that I'm seeing that I never even saw before.
Wow.
Where did that come from?
I do just want to say, it isn't. I don't think that sitting meditation, I don't think that's the only path. I think there are certain ways of, you know, looking inside that
and
are
he talks
equally,
about
equally useful and equally uncomfortable.
Of course. He talks about this, actually. At the very beginning, he says, this is not the only way to do this.
I mean, I wanted to share. So I think, talking about spiritual materialism, so I was telling my teacher, Michael, about a story. And it's really a poignant story, so... So one of the things, you know, I do a lot of walking, so of course people, you get in the crosswalk, they cut you off, and I got angry. And so I told them that I figured out this like thing, you know, like I don't know if you ever saw like anger management, it's like, repeat this mantra. So of course I thought, wow, I'm this, you know, great person now. And so Michael sort of, you know, pointed out, he goes, you don't want to be doing this spiritual exercise. The point is, don't get hit while you're in the crosswalk. yeah, you're right. So that's an extreme case of like spiritual material. I was being this like perfect spiritual guru or whatever. And you sort of pointed out. But that's just like one of so many things that I never saw before. It's like, oh my God.
And that's why, Roberta, what we were talking about last week about fixing, we can't fix it. There's nothing to be fixed. It reveals itself. And it's like being hit on the head with a fan.
So the story I was telling was that last week, and some people were here at the beginning, that I was handing the cushions out, and I put my cushion on the chair I wanted. And someone new who isn't back, and I have this horrible feeling they never come back, was sitting there and said, you're sitting on my chair. Like, whoa, that's a lot of my in that. I was like, oh, that came out of your mouth. You said that. Like, that's real. That's like not, that wasn't even just a nasty thought. You can pause for a second. And it really, but so... To Roberta's point, what it did is it helped me to notice when I was doing it more, you know, in smaller ways, that I could then notice and say, do I really need to be the person who says you're sitting on my cushion on my chair?
But I was there and it wasn't that nasty.
Well, it didn't come out that way,
right,
because I toned it down. Yeah. That's how I felt. If he'd been smaller, I would have... She's been my sibling.
This is my cushion and it's filled with all my embarrassing thoughts.
So now it is.
If cushions could talk.
You know what I appreciate so much about that story is I didn't really sign up to make myself uncomfortable, but I signed up to pay attention. Right? Mm-hmm. And then when I started paying attention, that kind of stuff happened. And then I went, oh, yeah, well, actually, that is what I signed up for. I didn't know it was going to be that. And so it doesn't all feel miserable.
Well, this is the good part about it, though, is that it's humbling and that we have this tendency to think of ourselves as spiritual people who are on the path. And, you know, that. And we built it.
Oh, I just opened it.
Congratulations. John, when you said signed up, I was thinking of those click-through agreements, like when you download iTunes. And you
know,
I had a really tough week with work, and I had a moment where my husband Frank came home, and he knew I had a tough time. He's like, what's going on? And I just, the more I talked about it, the more animated I get. And finally he said, I'm going to be very un-Buddhist right now, and I dropped an F-bomb. And he hugs me, and he goes, it's okay, sweetie, you're still a Buddhist.
I think you can't say fuck if you're a Buddhist.
Among other things, nothing is illegal. Nothing, actually. Which can be kind of scary, because we do love to have our systems, and even talks about this, you know, that we're really each one of us on our own. And yet we're creating a community of people who are willing to be vulnerable, willing to be open, willing to do the work. And something softens and opens. So there's a kind of funny solitary and kind of a group recognition that takes place. And we're leaping ahead a little bit, but he talks about how we're not trying to cultivate the universe. We're infiltrating by being wakeful. If we have the capacity to not pollute, to sort of approach the world with the kindness that we would want actually for ourselves, and the awareness that we would want people to have for ourselves. And if we multiply in that way by generating softness and kindness and goodwill, that's the way we can affect change, rather than either becoming a superhero cult leader, you know, or a member of the best Buddhist group in the town. You know that it isn't about credentials, it's zip credentials. That's the point, and that's very hard for us in this culture. Because look, this is sitting on the cushion is actually demanding work. It's really hard. You kind of want to go, I did that. and yeah, you did, but it's still not a credential. It's just something that you did. Were you going to say something, Lee?
I was saying you can have like a special badge.
Oh, jeez.
That's a whole
T-shirt. Which I don't need to go into right now, but okay. Yes.
One of the bosses
did that road. So, although we are extraordinarily interested in hearing some word of wisdom, if it's slanted toward personal demand, we shy away from it. So that's kind of, I thought that was a very interesting thing that he said, because it's demanding to sit on the cushion. It's not nothing. I mean, it's not like watching TV. It's rigorous. And he said he's not talking in terms of submission, but about working with ourselves. That's page 155, working with ourselves. So, getting back to what we were saying before, he talks about on 155, we can't be dilettantes because death is real. Death, this thing called death, will happen to us. When we encounter sickness, we can't be dilettantes. We're stuck with our aches and pains, our stuffed nose, or our cancer. We can't say that life was a rehearsal, and we'd like to move on to the real show. At some point, we have to stop and actually work on ourselves. I love this. I'm thinking, what is that? Who is it? On with the show, this is it. Bugs Bunny?
Yeah, Bugs Bunny.
Yeah. Sorry, a little detour. So, at page 156, here we are again, back with the five skandhas.
But he did it in like six sentences.
I know. Why didn't you know that?
How do we start with that before we tackle
that? I know. Does anybody wanna read about that? Because
no.
Can I just say he does it in a way that he talks of strategies that we employ to keep ourselves comfortably confused, which I thought really makes sense in a way, doesn't it? So,
yeah.
Please.
We've talked about the various strategies that we employ to keep ourselves comfortably confused and to construct an ego or self that seems solid and secure. The first level of this construction form is the basic dualistic fixation of me and other. The second stage, feeling, is trying to feel out yourself and your world fully to make sure you know who is for and against you. The third aspect, impulse, is continually jumping to conclusions, trying to stabilize the situation. The fourth aspect is concept, where you put everything into a pigeonhole. And the fifth stage is the general situation of consciousness, in which your ego can actually operate in a complete network where every entertainment is provided. If the big entertainments run out of steam, we produce little entertainments, which are known as subconscious gossip. Hopefully, everything is covered and everything's hunky-dory. We think that nothing can go wrong.
Could you read the next paragraph?
Sure. But there are always maintenance problems, not having enough entertaining subconscious gossip to occupy ourselves, or enough large-scale entertainment to fulfill our wishes. We have to find many babysitters to keep us occupied. You might find babysitters for 3 or 4 hours a day, but You can get a babysitter for can you get a babysitter for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Who's going to provide that level of entertainment for you all the time? That is infantile. That is an infantile, very soft approach. We might present ourselves as macho and try to look tough and self-reliant. We act as though we know how to deal with our business. We know how to deal with our boss, our subordinates, or our lovers. But if we haven't made friends with ourselves, it is a complete pretense. Actually, we are infantile, rather weak, soft, and pathetic.
And he's also saying it's not about becoming a macho meditation warrior. You know, the technique of meditation is part of the process that undoes or dismantles our egotism, very simply. And this is where we go into the fringe of emotions, which we also studied earlier in this chapter. And I don't know if anybody, that phrase fringe of emotions didn't make sense to anybody. It took me a little while to visually sort of understand what he was referring to, and what I see here is that through the process of meditation, we're working with letting go of our attachments to subconscious gossip and the thoughts that pop up that are triggered by all this maintenance activity. And as we're on the cushion practicing, we're cutting resist surrendering to them. Does that make sense? Yeah.
That first paragraph is really good. This is 157. With the practice of meditation to begin with, it is important to cut through the outskirts of the security ring of ego scheme, as we talked about in the chapter on working with the fringe of emotions. So that, to me, that really helped, because you think of the outer ring, and there's sort of the ego solidification there, and it's like making a pathway in. And then the chapter after that's the heart of emotions.
So yeah. It's sort of the opening.
That's right.
Cutting through the egos first.
The sword in the heart chapter.
That actually comes first, which is interesting. The sword in the heart, and then the fringe of emotions, and then the heart of emotions, I think. Heart of emotions.
Yeah. So I'm still struggling with a little. Is the fringe of emotions sort of like I carry this attitude about someone or something that's just very, like, not even really something I would be able to articulate, and then it pops up when something happens, like, oh, I can't believe they did that again.
Well, I think so. I think that's actually right. And I think that's where we actually start leaning from being on the cushion to out in the world. Mm. Exactly.
Is to sort of pick up on, like, oh, I say that all the time because
you
I'm carrying this little grudge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, there's millions of them. Millions of them little ways that we're constantly interacting. There's an inside and an outside, and if you're not sitting on the cushion, you're engaging. And so you have all those minutes that you're not, that you're actually practicing. He called it I wrote it down here, the practice of, did I underline it? No. It's a practice of being in the world, of awareness. It's actually not just that you're just practicing on the cushion.
Hmm.
That's really, because that's a different way of looking at what we're doing. And if we were just practicing so we're good meditators, there'd simply be no point in what we're doing.
So that fringe of emotions, there's one another sentence in that same paragraph where it talks about it's much better to work with situations on the fringe, which is working, as you said, Erica, with the subconscious mind and all kinds of superficial neurosis that we generate. Simply work with the fringe, as we've already discussed, rather than trying to be too ambitious at the beginning. We have fantasies and realities, so go beyond fantasy and reach reality. So at the edge, I think it's just the littler stuff. You know, it's not as big as a way in. That's what it
is. Is it kind of also staying away from trying to analyze?
Yes,
where it's
labeling.
Coming from?
Yes, because you're labeling.
Yeah.
On the cushion, you're actually not being seduced by it.
Right.
You're actually labeling it. You're actually going thinking.
Yeah.
And going right back to your technique.
Because it's not important to just wonder where it all came from. It's just to recognize it's there.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I thought that being on the fringe was more like just the basic watching and observing, not trying to go the juggler. Like,
no, it's not the juggler.
Because he goes, I don't know what page it's on, but I like this part where we can observe the style and intentions of our everyday life situations. I don't know what
is that the beginning of the
bottom of 157.
Is it 157?
Yes, it's right.
Yeah, bottom of 157.
Thank you.
The way we brew tea or cook an egg, the way we walk down the street. This is not watching with an intensely critical attitude, trying to catch ourselves before we do something wrong. This watching is based on unconditional mindfulness.
That's what I was looking for.
Which is seeing things as they are, very precisely. This is the way to cut through our deceptions. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking that's the fringe. That's a description of that kind of being on the edge.
Well, that particular paragraph was talking about being actually meditation in action or mindfulness in action.
Right. So still, isn't that a watchfulness that describes more of just being, it's observing. Like you might question, how can you know if you're actually watching yourself correctly or whether you're deceiving yourself? The truth of the matter is there's no telling. There's absolutely no telling. There's no list of do's and don'ts.
That's right. But, yes.
So I guess I interpreted the fringe as being more like, it's actually a very practical instruction. It's what you actually have access to. The things that you can perceive, the things that are as opposed to the bigger, the big concepts with a capital C. That those immediate things, are the things you can use to, as the tools, if you will. But I don't. So that it's just the fringe is more just what's accessible to you.
I think you're on the cushion. The fringe is all those thoughts that come up.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And just observing.
Exactly. Right. Labeling them.
And not trying to get, is this a do or a don't, or
judging or analyzing.
Or judging or an analyzing. Right.
But when you're in the world, you actually are mixed up in the middle of everything, and but at the same time, you're similarly observing yourself interacting with the world. So it's kind of a mixture, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's both.
Depending on the energy of the moment.
And so, mm-hmm. Excellent, because that goes into what he's talking about in terms of emotions.
Mm-hmm.
That how do we work with the energy that comes up?
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about earlier about anger.
Mm-hmm.
And like, how do you work with the anger that comes up if you're not going to reach for, if you're not going to want to if you're angry and you reach for a candy, you're not relating to the anger. You're reaching for you're avoiding it actually. You're
trying to feel differently. You're trying to make yourself feel differently
right.
than what you're feeling at that time.
Because it's very demanding to sit to actually just feel what you feel.
I guess I was asking because they were talking about like, you know, you're supposed to distance yourself. Like one of the steps, you're supposed to distance yourself. So like,
could you tell? Say what you're referring to.
Well, they're talking about how to like work with the emotions.
The Pumla Propitiate text.
Yeah,
that's you were reading.
Text, yeah,
right.
So there's like three
earlier.
Steps: like distance, friend, mm-hmm. and then it turns. So I was just looking at the distancing part. So I was asking her, like, well, you know, are you supposed to distance yourself for it for like 30 seconds or, and then it goes away, and then it's another
formal?
Minute. How long are you supposed
and
to
and are you doing
or
this?
Do you just, how long? or do you just eventually, you have to grab that candy bar, or over time you're not going to have to grab that candy bar. Like, I'm just, how long do you, I mean, maybe that's why it's a practice, because
right.
in the beginning you can only sit there for like 2 seconds, and then you, and maybe over
yeah.
time you can sit through it long enough where you can maybe make friends and
eventually. Yeah. And what does making friends mean? That's actually a great point.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to make friends?
Well, I don't know, just like meeting it.
Yeah.
I mean, like you just meet it and welcome it rather than,
mm-hmm.
to me that's what it means, rather than pushing it away. I mean, like, you know, I consider my wife my friend, so I'm not going to, like, push her away. I'm going to try to welcome her and accept. So I think it has to do with acceptance, that you
mm-hmm.
accept it as something that might be beneficial, even though it's, like, wrecking her. It's really painful, but then
it's also transient. It's also, all of it is transient. Nothing is permanent.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean because you're angry, you're an
mm-hmm.
angry fucker.
Feels
it means because you were angry, it was just, that was occurring. So you don't hold on to yourself as the identity
mm-hmm.
of this person, this uber impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's transient.
As it was either Pema Chodron or Tara Brach who said, inviting Mara to tea.
Right.
So
yeah.
Mara being anger. Right. And instead of trying to fight Mara, you invite Mara into tea.
We can't help it. I mean, if we've agreed that we're going to do that now.
Mm-hmm. See, I don't find that. I've been thinking about that fixing thing last week, and it's like there's nothing to be fixed, and hope and hopelessness. There's no such thing as hope or hopelessness. And actually, I find all of that very comforting.
Mm-hmm.
I find that the more you get to be friends with yourself or develop self-compassion, which is really, really tough, but there can be some comfort in doing that because things are difficult. Does that in some ways it's not as hard as it was before I thought that I could forgive myself, or before I thought I could be friends with myself, or before I thought there was hopelessness or hope. I don't know if that's making any sense.
But. Seems to me like it's like a journey with no real destination. Mm-hmm. And
right.
And similar to that, I think it's also comforting, even though it sounds like it shouldn't be. It actually is.
It actually is.
Just
yes.
to realize what is.
Right.
It's not a goal.
Mm-hmm. It's not, yeah.
Right.
So you don't have to say, when are we going to get there?
There's nothing we can miss. There's no missed opportunity that we're supposed to be.
Right. Yeah.
That we messed up at some point.
Yeah.
Right. So, like, what are we forgiving ourselves for, really? Yeah. Yeah, so that's actually more comforting than...
Are we there yet?
Yeah.
Are we there yet?
Are we there yet?
Yeah. And so all those thoughts, you know, are no longer accusations. They're just something that is happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? So it's not... Each of them isn't a reminder of what I haven't done. Mm-hmm. It's a thing. Mm-hmm. It's a thing. You said before here, really helpful, you know, we can stop believing in some of those thoughts. Mm-hmm. And it's... We just, you know, they... I think my training, my, I guess, education is, you know, the purpose of having ideas is that they serve a purpose and they're to be believed in. But they just kind of come and go. Right?
They just come and go?
Yeah.
Indeed they do.
Yeah. this just in.
Yeah. Just in.
Put it down in our room. Put it up on the web.
That's really interesting. I study history, and the world is really attached to, they think what historians do is go find all the exact right facts,
yes,
come
yes.
up with the truth, right?
Right?
And
right.
Historians are like, it's not at all what we're doing. I really do a lot of work in the public sector with museums and thoughts that kind of circulate publicly, and there's a social organization that does a lot of that, and they brought up the point that historians don't want to think about the now, they want to think about the past, but really what good is mm-hmm. even looking at the past if not to serve
yeah.
whatever we're doing now, you know? Like, it's not about getting fixated on, it's like, how are we moving through whatever we can learn?
And I recently heard something really interesting vis-a-vis that, is that I think we maybe even talked about that. That what we're doing now really isn't for us. It's for the people of the future. I mean, and it was really just breathtaking when you think about the selfishness of, like, I want my mind. Whatever.
Yeah. My
cherishing.
My eye on it, you see.
But it's really for the future. I mean, it's really not about
right.
being mine.
What's even the point
it's
of studying the past or our own past if not to serve the present or the future?
Yeah.
Because really, otherwise, I mean, it's over. Those people are dead. Those people are dead. They're not here. It's not for them.
That phrase keeps coming to mind. 100 years, all new people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, there was another. I read another book recently. That the idea that everything is a story, including like 5 minutes ago. So it's not. that analysis of what does that matter applies to. You know, everything that we're experiencing right now. You know, all of a sudden, oh, it's the past.
It's right.
Now.
Yeah.
But what we see in history depends on how we are now. Because what I'm seeing in museums, all of a sudden there's all this stuff about Black history. Where was that 30 years ago? Nobody even thought about putting them in the museum, you know? That there's the Newton, this museum, like, right near your house on Waverly, you know, right close to Newton Center, where there were slaves there. And there was a Kendrick house. Durant Kendrick house. Amazing, you know, and, you know, Well, it's a new museum, but, you know, years ago, like, all these places didn't have anything about slavery at all.
You can't make a museum exhibit without acknowledging it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's being incorporated. So you realize how much of what we see and believe is from the things that, or you just start to see how much is left out, you know. There's so much left out. There's so many people and so many different kinds of people and women, whatever. History is just, you know, it's very selective. And then we have a belief system based on that, or we don't even really have a wide range of what we see.
Yeah, we happen to know all museum professionals for having that conversation.
Yeah. I'm with you there.
Phew. So, just getting back to the chapter here, what you were referring to earlier about going about our daily activities and our unconditional mindfulness, did anybody pick up on that? That we he talked about observing yourself making tea and observing yourself through your days, that daily activities and your interactions, but we could talk about how you manifest your own awake quality. Do you wash your own dishes? Do you replace the toilet paper? Do you, you know, down to a minute level, how you function? It's actually compassionate if you think about it, because it isn't just I'm going to be a good person. It's that actually we see our own little tendency towards our own little deceptions. Like, let somebody else deal with it. But all of a sudden we're a little more aware of how we're affecting the world. And you've talked about that. And it just seems at this point in our group and with our practice, this is really beginning to percolate in us as a group, this sort of sense of awareness that we're not just in it for ourselves and our own good meditation experience, but that actually it's on an everyday level how we are not going to be letting ourselves get away with being unaware of our own effect in the world. And he described it as unconditional mindfulness. So and he said no one can tell you whether you're on the mark or not. You know it. Only you know when you're deceiving yourself or when you're trying to, those Real Housewives are seducing you. Pulling you. Yeah, I just gotta go. Nope.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
That phrase, unconditional mindfulness, it puts you back to being an observer.
So, what's the difference between awareness and observing? I guess that would be really
a
question to raise.
I guess I think observing, you know, it sounds like you're more distant. You know, in awareness, it seems like you're more in with what you're doing. You know, you're cooking the egg. Instead of like standing over there, I am cooking the egg.
Right.
Something. And,
well, and also observer to me is a me observing.
Yes.
And awareness seems more like I'm not there, it's just what's there.
I don't know.
Awareness seems intimate, maybe.
I'm sorry?
Awareness seems more intimate or more connected.
Okay, if you're in the middle of a fight with your wife or husband or partner, and that energy is cooking, I mean, it's hot. It's huge. And you feel it, and you feel the sort of brightness of the room and the energy, and you don't know, that's, you're aware of that. That's what we're talking, right? You're not unaware of that.
I think one is awareness to experience it versus observer thinking about it.
You like writing the story down.
It's like you talk about eating, that you can think about reading a recipe in a book about a soup until you actually make it, taste it. You're not aware of it. So I think to me, awareness is get to actually experience what's happening to be aware. Whereas observer, you could be, looking through binoculars.
And it's really a razor's edge too, isn't it though? Mm. Because when you're feeling that, it could go any way. It isn't like it's safe there. It isn't safe to fall in love. It isn't safe to have an emotional state. And there's something very alive about it, and it's unconditional, actually. So it's your awareness is also on the spot. Does that make any sense? No. Yeah.
I think whenever there's always a sentence or two where I read it and I think that sounds like too much of a too good a thing to the sentence that bothered me here was actually this: watching is based on unconditional mindfulness, which is seeing things as they are very precisely. I sort of have a vow to stay away from conversations wherever people are talking about about the true nature of reality. And I think the second paragraph after that makes it clear that it's more like a direction to yourself. But the idea of unconditional mindfulness and seeing things as they are, that seems like that's the bodhisattva state rather than something that one would attain in a regular life and a regular practice.
I guess it seems unrealistic.
Or
too absolute.
It's sort of like it's the big rock candy mountain, that it's not, it's a little bit too, this sort of blissful and, I'm unconditionally mindful and I see reality, it's a very tempting sentence.
Except, again, you said, I'm unconditioned. There wouldn't be somebody going, I'm being unconditionally mindful.
Because it's the absolute rather than the relative.
Okay.
And it's, again, like everything on the spot. It isn't a permanent...
We don't get that microwave zap.
Okay.
I was going to say it's not all the time.
Oh, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, on occasion.
And some moments feel more awake than others, right? Some are heightened.
So what does the unconditional mean in this context?
Well, that's a good question. What do you think? Or what does anybody think? I think, I'll just say that it seems like his basis is where it's not all about me. That you observe, you're engaged and you are aware, you could say observing your engagement, you're engaging, but you're not all in for me. That there's, the space is what's dominant.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
The space in which things are occurring opens up.
Okay, so it's more of the whole surround that
Correct.
You're describing. Makes more sense. Okay.
And I think he very clearly would not want you to buy anything. You're not buying anything. This is the way it is. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the material says nobody can tell you
right.
whether you're on or off. You're doing it by yourself.
That's essentially the understanding of unconditional love, too, right? Sort of like accepting the fluidity of life and others and what's happening and allowing the space for that.
It's
not putting a condition on it.
Right. It's not dependent on conditions.
It can't be chopped up.
Right, because conditions are about defining.
Right.
It's about creating this is what's acceptable, this is what's not acceptable.
Uh-huh.
You're boundaries. Removing the conditions and you're just saying, that's what it is, right there.
Mm-hmm. Removing your conditions.
Yeah. Because the moment you start creating conditions, you're starting to create a box.
Right.
To put in. And anything outside that box, well, that doesn't exist. It's just what's inside the box. So I think that's what the word unconditional means to me, which is letting go of conditions of what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, what I like, what I don't like. Yeah. And that, I think, falls into unconditional love.
Here's just an example of having a child and nothing they can do. There's no condition on that.
Yeah.
No boundary.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, whether they have, you know, three fingers or walking, or like you just, no matter what they, whatever arises, like it has to do with acceptance. It's just acceptance no matter what. Unconditional, it's no matter what happens, the love is always there.
Even if they're a teenager?
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're a teenager.
No, I've got three, so I'm not going like, to go past that stage.
Where this chapter is going is that we bring through this awareness and through this path that we're each of us is on, where we are becoming softer and kinder and more open, and that our engagement with the world becomes more it's like our hearts, our chests have been, we've had an operation, and our chests have been opened up, and our heart is right there.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it without discrimination, i.e. there's not good people that we'll open our hearts to, and the crummy people that we're going to shut down. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's demanding. It isn't. So,
well, I think like what you said, teenagers, and I'd say as a mom to not quite teenagers anymore, is especially teenagers, because and you open up your heart and you get stomped on and it's painful, and you say I love you, and you're grounded. So it is especially difficult with teenagers, and that's when they need it the most.
And for yourself, when you do it, you're opening up your heart for yourself too, which is the Maitri part of it that he talks about. And the our broken heart is what enables us, or our open heart is what enables us to see other people's heart.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise we're demons, like we're strong, mighty, credentialed meditators. That's not what we're doing.
Well, I love the sentence. The credentials. I mean, it's great. It's at the bottom of 160. The strength of the tradition relies on giving up every credential every minute. So, you know, that says it, man. Cut away where we're going. There's no goal. There's no. It's just all the credentials, whatever we think we're going to pile up behind us.
We're on the same page.
You highlighted it too, and I put two stars.
You didn't check before.
I have barely minutes of mindfulness now. I don't want to give that up.
Right. I'm always amazed when I open my heart that way, not to teenagers. Actually, I can't speak to that. They're different animals, beasts of some kind. But adults, first of all, I'm amazed at how many people meet me there who had not met me there before.
Yeah.
But
Secondly, I'm really amazed at how when people don't meet me there, I'm more able to just say, oh, you didn't meet me there.
Mm. Yes.
You can let go of that.
I can trust me.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. There's an integrity. Mm-hmm. That's really what it is, right? There's like an integrity in the intention. And if you come with that integrity of intention, it kind of doesn't matter if they meet you there. You know,
it's intention without expectation.
Yeah.
And ironically, I think when you present that, they have the more freedom to actually meet you there because you're not expecting it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with teenagers, then, you take away. See, for teenagers, what they enjoy the most is not doing what you want. Mm-hmm. And so when you're like, it's okay. Like kids I work with, they know.
And right? You're grounded.
Well, I don't get this, but they, you know, they push and push. And when I first came there, one of the other teachers said, you know, they keep pushing and pushing, and there's nothing to push against.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they can stop. But as soon as you push back, then it,
yeah,
then
yeah,
that's the game. Uh-huh. The whole game.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much more, and we're out of time. I would recommend if you haven't read the afterword, really do, and it just does. It just keeps going, this book. So I think we're cooked.
Yeah. So I just wanted to mention next week we have a special program. Entertainment. It's a wonderful movie. It's called Live and Become, and it's very powerful. So, in a way, it opens the gateway to our next study, which is the Mahayana and compassion. So, this movie is about the airlift in 1984, I think, called Operation Moses of the Ethiopian Jews and resettlement in Israel. And it's on so many levels, issues of racism, religion,
motherhood
is a big topic.
Openness and closeness
and secrets. I realized when I watched it with Erica that all the main characters, each one held a secret. And I never noticed that even before. So it's so be sure to come on time if you can, because we're going to start right around 7 or maybe 5 after, because it's a 2 hours and 20 minutes. So if you need to leave, you can just, you know, sit in the back and walk out, but you probably won't want